Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
One or two things in my life, but never, never anything like this.
Maybe did a bad, bad thing. Maybe did a bad, bad thing. Maybe did a bad, bad thing. Maybe did a bad, bad thing.
You ever loved someone so much you thought your little heart was gonna break into?
Hello, welcome to Rewatchability. It's the podcast where we take a look at movies and TV shows we haven't seen in a while and see how they hold up today. Today, right now, when you're listening to this, I'm J.M. McNabb, joined as always by...
Oh, so specific. Blaine Waters.
And...
Robert LaRonde.
And we have a special guest. It's our friend Johnny Walker is back. Hey, Johnny.
Yeah!
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Good.
Okay.
I mean, not really.
Yeah. 2020, man, has been...
Good.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining us, John.
It's a treat, as always, even in these troubling times.
You're a ray of sunshine for us.
Oh, go on, please.
We're doing this over Zoom, and your room is the only one with color in it.
That's true, yeah.
Literally a ray of sunshine.
Mine has some mold.
I am in the murder basement. I look like I'm hanging out with Buffalo Bill down here.
That's very true.
All we can see is rafters.
We are an Entertainment One podcast, and we do have a very special episode. I know I say that all the time, and it's usually a lie, but this time I think we actually do have a special movie to talk about. It is the... what's come to be kind of a Christmas classic for some people, Eyes Wide Shut,
mm-hmm.
which is the 1999 Stanley Kubrick picture. I mean, this movie has been talked about a lot, but we asked Johnny to come on the show. We asked him to select a holiday film for us to talk about, and this was your suggestion. So let's start with you, Johnny. When did you first see Eyes Wide Shut? Why did you suggest it for today?
Just to be clear, y'all have done a lot of holiday movies already, so I was attempting to find something that had not already...
Johnny, I told you anything you wanted, the sky's the limit, and you chose this one, so...
But it's hard to think of a movie in which Christmas lights are a more constant presence than Eyes Wide Shut. Yeah, it occurred to me as a kind of a bit of an offbeat, a little bit of a Christmas adjacent pick. I think the first time I actually saw the movie was when I was in first year university and I downloaded it in residence off of the shared network that all of the students had.
Ooh.
And I just remember seeing like Blade Runner and Eyes Wide Shut for the first time in that way, just like on my really crappy laptop in my dorm room while my roommate was like practicing his nunchucks on the other side of the room as a kind of, you know, a cool adult thing to do. I had been totally aware of the movie before. It came out in 99, we said. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I would have been just entering grade 9 when the movie came out in theaters. I don't know if I would have like even... Are we like allowed to go see an R-rated movie if you're 14, you're not, right? I don't think I could have even seen this movie.
No.
In the theaters, unless I'd like gone with my parents, and it didn't really seem...
That would have been awkward.
Yeah.
There's another way, and I will tell you about it when it comes to my turn.
But, you know, I think that before I watched it all the way through, I certainly, like, I was very aware of the marketing campaign, which was very, I feel like, very omnipresent when it came out. The whole, just everything, the Tom and Nicole of the movie, the Kubrick's last hurrah of the movie, the extreme backlash against the movie. And then I think I'd seen bits and pieces of it on the Showcase Drambuie review. there were certain scenes that I remember I'd seen out of context, and I was like, what is this movie? What's it all about? But it was, it was first year university when I finally saw the whole thing all the way through.
Mm-hmm. Now we come to you two. You two guys. How many times have you seen The Fifth Element, Blaine?
More than five.
Okay, so you guys never saw this movie. Am I correct?
You're correct.
Yeah. I mean, I remember all of the hype. I remember all of the... I remember seeing it, I guess, through the lens of Entertainment Tonight.
Yeah.
The sexiest lens.
You know, there was the whole Tom and Nicole, they are an actual couple, and they are in this movie, so that should be hot. And the movie is supposed to be hot. Like, it's very, like, erotic and steamy.
Baby did a bad, bad
thing. Oh, my God. And, yeah, that song was, like... That's a sexy song. I don't know how Chris Isaak just writes these sexy songs. Just like, I don't know. It's weird.
Very sexy dude.
That's the only thing he has to do. That's his job.
Well, and wasn't he in Twin Peaks?
That's true. Sometimes he does that. You know, I remember, speaking of Entertainment Tonight, I remember when that first teaser trailer hit that had, like, the, you know, a bit of nudity and everything, and it had that song, you know, it's basically that scene from the movie,
right?
And no one knew anything about what the plot was or anything, and they tracked down Chris Isaak and got a comment from him, and all he said, you know, you got to be careful licensing your songs to movies because it could have, like, nudity or offensive content, and if it has both those things, you say yes. That's all he said.
That's great.
And that poster was everywhere, I feel. The purple poster with Nicole looking in the mirror.
I remember that. I remember that, like, at the video store.
Right.
Yeah.
Very iconic.
Right near the section with beads as a door. That's where that poster was. Yeah, I've never seen this movie before. I know that it was, like, you know, a risque movie. I knew that it was Stanley Kubrick. I had heard very mixed reviews. I'd heard from a friend that I trust very much that it's one of his favorite movies of all time, and then Jam, and then
it's not my favorite movie of all time. That would be ridiculous, but it is.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay.
And then I've heard from other people that it's just like, just skip it. You don't need to see it. There's been better movies.
To be fair, you watch a lot of garbage movies.
Yeah, but they were saying that to me, knowing that I watch garbage movies. They're like, you should probably watch those movies.
I'm just saying. You still could have shimmied this in there. I'm just saying.
And so I was really interested to see it. And I can't wait to talk about it. So, JM.
All right.
Yeah.
When was the first time you saw this movie?
Well, I saw it when I came out, because the other way to see R-rated movies was to sneak into
them.
You buy a ticket to another movie, and then you go in.
Oh, God. You were like Tom Cruise at that orgy.
Did you have to say a password?
Yeah, it was a password-based Cineplex.
Sounds to me like Baby did a bad, bad thing.
I did have a baby with me. I shouldn't have done that. No, it was... I was so hyped up for it, too, because, like... You know, I think those moments are meaningful. Like, when you're young and you get into a thing, whether it's like a band or a filmmaker or something that seems like it's of the distant past, and then they have a new thing come out that you can kind of be a part of. And for me, Eyes Wide Shut was one of those things, because it had been like a year or two before that I'd gotten into Kubrick. I'd seen, you know, Clockwork Orange, and I think I'd seen 2001 already, but, you know, I rewatched it and really started to get into to all of the Kubrick films, and the, you know, understanding a bit more about who he was and his work. So having like his film coming out and having it be his last film, I had a minor obsession with this movie coming out, which is not something I would have even remembered until a few months ago. And I was cleaning out my old room at my parents' house, and I found newspaper clippings from this was before like the internet was what it is today. So like when there was an article about Eyes Wide Shut in the paper, I clipped it out, and I found all of these newspaper clippings about Eyes Wide Shut
and a Venetian mask
and a Venetian, and a threatening note from Sidney Pollack.
What did your parents think? Like, were they like, because you were young, you were younger than 18, you know, the legal age of seeing this movie. Were they like, this is going to change my son? Like, what were their thoughts?
No, I don't think so.
Sex isn't really like that. It's less orgies, you know, more one-on-one.
I think my parents were probably more concerned with like violence. Like they bought me the tape when it came out that year too. So like, I don't think they care. And like, you know,
let's put it on after dinner.
Give us the RoboCop, have Eyes Wide Shut.
Yeah. And my dad was super into movies. So it's not like some weird hobby. He knew I was getting into movies and that Kubrick was a huge figure. So it was understandable. And yeah, I loved it. And I think it's a movie. It's one of those movies, like a lot of Kubrick movies, that evolves over time, partly because you age with it and partly because, you know, I don't think we'll get to your opinions of the movie as we go, but I think generally with Kubrick, and this also speaks to the reception the movie got when it was first released, I think his movies are meant to be seen more than once. I think, you know, certainly like when we talked about The Shining years ago, like that is a movie that oddly gets scarier the more you see it, as opposed to, you know.
Right.
I think, you know, I was listening to Joe Dante on his podcast the other day, and he said he phrased it as, you know, some movies don't always give up all their secrets on a first viewing. And I think a lot of Kubrick movies are like that. So that being said, I was a fan. I've been a fan for years. I have a lot to say about this movie. I will say before we get into it, I've never really thought of it as a Christmas movie. And I know some people do. I don't know if they're just doing that to be kind of contrarians to, like, you know, the sort of whole holiday vibe. But, well, for one thing, I would never tell someone what is or isn't a Christmas movie. That's kind of a personal decision. But in terms of this rewatch, I was very much looking at it through the lens of, could I rewatch this as a Christmas movie? Because that was never really a thing for me. So that's where I was at with this rewatch.
Cool.
I think it's a great retort to the next bro at a bar who tells you, like, well, actually Die Hard is a Christmas movie, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
It's
as much a Christmas movie as that.
It's certainly aesthetically, yeah. It's the most Christmas if you go by, like, the lights and the sets. Yeah. Yeah. More so than Die Hard.
I'm sorry to be rude to Die Hard. I know where I am. I know.
No, it's fine.
No, it's fine.
You're Nakatomi Plaza, son of a bitch.
Just get it.
Okay, but I feel like Christmas is like a character almost in this. Like, it sort of reflects or contrasts with the texture of what's happening, right?
Yeah, like, it's not incidental. You know? He knows when you're sleeping, he knows when you're awake.
Just like the shadowy figures in that orgy.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think there is a purpose to the Christmas lights and the Christmas trees and the Christmas decorations. I think we'll talk about it as we go along, but I will say, I think the big, like, you almost feel it more than you, like, consciously think about it, but the big kind of revelation for me watching it now, thinking about the Christmas stuff, is that, you know, it's everywhere he goes, it's constantly Christmas, except for the orgy.
Mm-hmm.
The orgy mansion.
Can't we just hang some mistletoe?
Put a little Bing Crosby on instead of creepy synthesizer man? No, but I think that's very purposeful. Like, it's even if you don't, like, register it on a conscious level, like, it is a starkly different vibe when you get to that house. Because of the lack of Christmas lights. It's literally every single place he goes, even when it makes no sense, there's Christmas decorations in this movie. Okay, so Rob, do you want to run down the plot of Eyes Wide Shut? Being careful not to, you know, tip off the Illuminati to anything we might be privy to or anything that will get us killed.
You guys aren't in the Illuminati? Oh, shit. We shouldn't be doing this podcast. I'm going to get killed or something. Okay.
What's the other password, Rob?
I don't know. Shit. Okay, so the movie starts with Nicole Kidman's butt. And this is a movie that stars Tom Cruise, Nicole Kidman's butt, and then somewhere down the marquee, Nicole Kidman, I think, somewhere. Because there's like a lot of Nicole Kidman's butt in this movie. I think.
And the butts of many other women with pretty much identical bodies.
Yeah. It's true, yeah. It's like Nicole Kidman and everybody else who auditioned for that role. But it's Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman, this actual couple at the time, playing this couple, the Harfords, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And what are their first names?
Bill and Alice.
Bill and Alice. Very, very nice American names.
Dr. Bill.
And they're getting... They're getting ready, Dr. Bill. They're getting ready to go to a Christmas party because it is Christmas. And it's Sidney Pollack's Christmas party. It's nice of him to throw a Christmas party being a Jewish person. But this is like one hell of a party. I mean, this isn't your typical like eggnog and mistletoe and a little bit of whatever. But it's a crazy party. I mean, it's first of all... He's very rich, so it's huge. There's a lot of people there. It's very high class. Immediately, Tom Cruise, he sort of goes off and starts talking to two beautiful young women. And Nicole Kidman, she starts to talk to this older gentleman, this sort of European Lothario. It's sort of like Don Amici when he got into the cocoon pool. He's like, he's got his mojo back, it seems like, for the night. He's probably like the test patient for Viagra or whatever. And they are just having like a very intimate time. He asks her to dance and they do. And it's like, it's a very erotic dance. This isn't the way that we dance at the Much Music video dances, you know? And he keeps trying to seduce her, and she's not quite going along with it, but there's like a little bit of temptation there. And there's also the sense that maybe she's sort of doing this because Tom Cruise is flirting with these other two attractive women, maybe.
You know why women used to get married, don't you?
Why don't you tell me?
It was the only way they could lose their virginity. And be free to do what they wanted with other men. The ones they really wanted.
Fascinating.
But anyway, Tom Cruise, he has to go and deal with this medical situation because he is a doctor. And Sidney Pollack, this woman that he was with, has... had some sort of reaction or overdose to some drugs, and
in the most beautiful bathroom you've ever seen in your life.
It is really nice. Oh,
yeah. It's a good bathroom.
If you're gonna OD, OD in a bathroom like that.
Wow.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you find a place and then that's, yeah, find, get out your kit, you know?
I will say, I just want to point out, I think this is a very funny movie a lot of the time. Like, it's very dark and it's very scary and it explores a lot of heavy themes, but I think it's often very funny. And there's nothing funnier to me than Sidney Pollack wearing no shirt but with the suspenders on.
That was pretty good, yeah. It's just suspenders are hilarious. They really need to come back. And I guess, like, back in the day, people wore their clothes looser, too. So they sort of, like, just sort of hung on you. Anyway, it's great. Sidney Pollack, also, he's best known as a director, but as an actor, he's great in this. It's really nice to just see him perform. So, yeah, though, yeah, it does suck that there's a woman overdosing because, you know, he's not taking care of her or whatever. But anyway, so... all this stuff happens at the party, and then they go home. And oh, and he also meets his old friend from medical school, Nick Nightingale.
Great name. He was going to be a lounge act. He couldn't help it with that name. Come on.
Yeah, they were like, you're just not cut out for medical school. We're looking for people with doctor names like Price or
There's
or
never
Bill.
Been a Dr. Nightingale ever. So get out of here.
A nurse?
Yeah, great name for a nurse.
Good name for a nurse.
You can be a nurse. But so he's forced to become a jazz pianist. He has to go back to jazz school and learn to be a pianist. But he seems to be having a good time, and he invites Tom Cruise to come see him play at his regular gig.
The Coco Bongo Club.
Says, yeah.
So that way, that was a mask. Sorry.
What a great shout out to the Coco Bongo Club.
Guys, help small businesses out. Yeah. Go support the Coco Bongo.
The Coco Bongo is really struggling.
That everyone is shit-faced at this party. Mm-hmm. Everyone is so drunk, and there's all of these lingering shots of the most gorgeous, ridiculously overstocked bar with like every possible kind of liquor you've ever heard of for like a single event.
Yeah. But no Bud Light.
It's also like everyone is talking so slow.
Yeah.
Because maybe the director gave them line readings. Slow. Then I don't know why they're
doing
talking.
That. Keep doing that. We'll get the ASMR audience.
I'll just like touch my microphone. Yeah. Anyway.
Yes. Okay. Nicole Kidman. It's her in particular. She's doing like a thing with her voice, and it's hard to tell like whether she is performing for this guy, for you know this septuagenarian, or whether this is like. Her choice.
Well, there's also I one thing I noticed watching it this time. I don't know if I thought about this before, but like how similar to The Shining this movie is in a lot of ways.
Oh, totally. And
oh, yeah.
This whole sequence felt like the ballroom stuff in that movie.
Yeah.
I honest to God had the same thought.
I thought the exact same thing. I was like, this is like what one of those like Overlook parties back in the day was all about, for sure.
Yeah.
Where's the dude in the bear costume?
Actually, you know, this is, I'm sure this is just a coincidence, but there was like one of the early versions of the outline for The Shining or something had a scene where there was an orgy, like a ghost orgy.
Man.
Oh, man.
Yeah. You got to get a towel for the ectoplasm, though.
That's why Kubrick got involved. That's every Kubrick movie had an orgy in it.
Okay, but so the next night, after they go home, they are smoking a little bit of pot, and Nicole Kidman, I mean, they start to have this sort of fight where, like, they're sort of talking about whether or not Tom Cruise was worried that she would do something, and he says he's not because women aren't sort of like that, and he wouldn't do anything because he loves her, and she is kind of upset by this for some reason.
His argument is quite weak.
Yeah, it's a bit weak. And he's like, you smoke some bad pot, you know? You're getting too angry with your pot, which isn't a thing.
Her pot reaction is extreme.
It's basically, yeah.
And makes me feel like that's not maybe the drug for Nicole.
She basically reacts like a 1930s like hygiene film or something.
It's possible that she's smoking a sativa and she should really be smoking an indica. Like it could be a simple matter of prescribing something different. That's what I'm thinking.
There's a moment where she's doing this sort of little girl baby voice while talking about like someone getting their nipples tweaked that is just like, it's highly unpleasant.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, it's so weird.
I mean, the opposite of ASMR.
Her performance, even in this scene as well, is like super strange. And she is doing like a baby talk thing. And I thought it was like weird. But the other thing that it made me think of was something that Elizabeth Taylor does in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? And it's like this, game that she's playing. But it made me think that, like, this sort of, like, is constructed very similar. And it feels very much like, you know, one of those sort of Edward Albee-type plays where, right. like, couples are bickering at each other.
Yeah.
Especially at that part.
It goes to the nth degree so fast.
And also, she is so good in the scene, I think, because, yes, it starts out very broad and theatrical, but, like, she is so captivating still. She just, like, holds your attention and then brings it to this, like, dark, upsetting place and just like torpedoes all of Tom Cruise-iness.
Yeah. I mean, the twist is really good where she starts talking about this time where she had desire for a man who was a naval man, a belly button guy, and he he made her feel so much in her loins that she would have given up everything, her life, her child, her marriage with Tom Cruise. And Tom Cruise is just watching this, devastated. And yeah, I think it's a really good performance.
If you men only knew.
I don't know about the performance, though. I just don't know if I like their performance. Like, I don't know, in this movie. It feels so like, oh, like they're trying to act so hard. Maybe it's for a reason, but I don't know what reason it's for.
Well, I think it's very disarming. Like, I think that there could have been a million versions of that scene that are like sort of like smoldery and flirty, and you know, they have that sort of like sexy couple interplay. But I think that that is not necessarily like an interesting note at all. And yeah, I think, as JM said, the contrast there is sort of, I think, interesting anyway. Even if I don't like the earlier part of the performance, but I think once she starts talking about the Navy dude, then it's kind of, you know, she draws me in for sure.
And okay? I think one thing you have to kind of lock into in this movie, otherwise you're not going to have a good time, is the dreaminess of it, is the heightened reality of it. Like, this is not a movie that's supposed to take place in any kind of reality. Like, it's literally based on a book called, that translates as Dream Novel. Like, it's about exploring, you know, components of your own mind. And so everything's like a little heightened, everything's like a little out of lockstep with the real world. And I think all of the performances reflect that. And especially like Kidman here. Like, it's, you know, it's about, it's, you know, not even necessarily like, you know, representing, I mean, it's literally not representing something real. She's talking about like the infidelity of just an abstract thought she had once. Like, it's it's all supposed to be very surreal. I don't know how to describe it, but exactly.
Then it kind of starts with like this, the minutia of like a life. It almost feels slice of life at the beginning, where they're just like, oh, we're going out to this party, and they're talking to the babysitter, and it feels very real then. And I don't know,
I don't know if it does, because they immediately go to the party, and the party is very dreamlike.
And that's where it goes crazy for me.
Yeah. Well, but I think you're supposed to have like a foundation of, you know, this couple being real. I think that's important to the story that we're going to tell. But I think that the story we're going to tell is a story about, you know, dream logic and like exploring the subconscious. I mean, this was based on a book that came out in the 20s by a guy who was like friends with Freud in Vienna. So it's, you know, right. It's a product of that time where people were starting to kind of take a look at dreams as this possible, you know, way to decode the human mind or all these hidden thoughts. So like it's kind of dated in a way, but I think it works in a modern context in a big way, because you don't see a lot of movies trying to do that. You don't see a lot of movies playing in that arena. So, anyway, sorry, keep going.
But so intentionally Tom and Nicole too, right? I mean, how can you fully invest in the sort of the everyday, you know, I feel like there's something so Brechtian just in the casting there, where it's like, you can't watch this movie and not be aware that you're watching a movie about who were at the time the biggest stars in Hollywood.
Yeah.
It's weird looking back on it now, because obviously they're divorced and like he's become like a bit of this weird punchline figure, but he wasn't then. And at the time it was like, you want to see this movie because these are the two biggest, sexiest stars in Hollywood and you want to see them fuck. And you see the two of them after the party kissing, and he's kissing her, and she looks in the mirror, and she's like looking right at you, the audience looking at her, being like, yeah, you're watching us all the time. You're watching us right now, and I'm watching you.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Wow.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I mean, and that's the image on the poster, too.
Totally, yeah. It's a really striking moment, I think.
And in terms of like the intimacy, like, that you get from having that couple, I think that's why I think they can go to these like big places in terms of the performance, because it feels so real. I think in part because they're good, and partly because we know they're a real couple, and partly because they can play that in ways that two actors that aren't married in real life wouldn't be able to do.
Yeah.
Like, they actually slept on that set. They, like, lived there.
Oh, that's really weird.
Probably boned there and did, like, Dianetics tests.
I do have some stuff to say about that later.
Okay. But so, at this point, Tom Cruise is called away to deal with a patient who has died. And he goes there, and the woman tries to seduce him. Everybody is so horned up in this movie. And but he's not having any of it. He denies her, and she's sad about that. But after that, he goes...
And then Greg walks in. From Dharma and Greg.
Oh, yeah.
Dharma, get off.
Thomas Gibson.
Wow.
Oh, man, what if he had called her Dharma, and you realize this whole movie was set in the Dharma and Greg verse?
Yeah. It's just, you're so zany. Why are you so zany? I love
Kubrick
you.
Kubrick loved Dharma and Greg. It's true. But then he goes to visit a prostitute because,
And it's the girl from Hocus Pocus.
Is it?
Yeah, it's Allison.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Playing the same character.
Right. Yeah.
She now goes by Domino.
Yeah, and he, you know, he's about to do the thing that you do when you hire a prostitute and
sex worker.
And
it's not 1999 anymore.
But his wife calls, and he loses his boner. So he pays her because that's the proper thing to do. You know,
that's what a gentleman
guy.
Does.
He's a gentleman. But, and then he doesn't have sex with her. And then he leaves and he goes and sees his friend Nick at the jazz club, watches some jazz. He doesn't have to watch much jazz.
Thankfully.
Yeah, because it's pretty much the end of the set. But he talks to Nick Nightingale, and he's like, actually, I got another gig downtown later on tonight. But get this. It doesn't start till 2 o'clock.
I also love, because he's in this scene, he drops the bit that he's from Seattle, and he's like, you got to go where the work is. It's like, what? You flew across the country to, like, play in this dingy club for 8 people? Like, how much could that possibly, that wouldn't cover
There's
your
clubs
flight.
In Seattle. Yeah.
There's no music scene in Seattle. No one's ever heard of a musician from Seattle.
He's tired of doing jazz covers of grunge.
Have you not heard the theme song to Frasier?
Yeah. Yeah. But so Tom Cruise is talking to Nick Nightingale. Nick gets this call, which is going to tell him the location of this very secret party and the secret password, which he writes down on a piece of paper, which is not so secret. And Tom Cruise reads it, because reading upside down is not a difficult thing. And the password is Fidelio. And he sort of strong-arms his friend into telling him where the party is. And he says he'll arrive separately. And his friend says, "You can't. It's going to be, you know, it's not even worth it. You need to go get a costume first." So Tom Cruise has to go get a costume. And he goes to the costume shop, and that's a whole to-do. And there's like this scene with the shopkeeper's daughter.
It's Lily Sobieski, the bad guy from The Saint.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
You remember it? No? Okay.
Wow.
This movie exists in so many different universes. It's crazy how he brought them all together for this one movie.
Kubrick loved all those things, and then he just... That's what he did. But, so he gets the costume, he gets the cloak, he gets the mask, he gets the tuxedo. He's dressed up like Tuxedo Mask. But he goes to the party, and he gives the password... Fidelio, and they let him inside, and you know, it seems to be, I mean, it's like an orgy, but I don't know, it's kind of like a very vanilla boring orgy. I'm like, you know, there's a bunch of models.
It's basically
everybody...
Sleep No More.
It's Sleep No More, but
that,
with sex.
I mean, that was
that's what it
came out after Eyes Wide Shut, right? Like, that must have been inspired by Eyes Wide Shut.
Oh yeah.
True.
Must have been.
True.
Mm-hmm.
But he is sort of participates. He gets sort of shown around because there's like, I don't know, it's like they do a stroll with the naked women. All the women are just wearing these like G-string things, and all the men, I assume they're all men, are wearing full-on cloaks and tuxedos. So it seems very one-sided. And
I mean, it does feel like an art installation. It's true.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like feels like there should be a corner with like, you know, inexpensive wine and Dixie cups.
Yeah, and he gets shown around the place, but one of the women in a particularly, you know, big mask says that he isn't supposed to be there, and everybody knows it, and it's very dangerous, and he should leave. But Tom Cruise follows his boner, and he doesn't leave, and he keeps going, and, you know, they see some more sex things. There's some pretty, like, you know, acrobatic sex happening. Like, it seems like it's more cirque than sex, you know?
Well, you know, they hired those extras that were doing, like, the sexual positions were dancers.
That makes a lot of sense.
So they, like, worked hard to choreograph all that stuff.
Yeah. But he gets to this other point, and they ask him for the password. And he says, Fidelio. And then they're like, there's a second password.
And he goes, Nightingale?
Would you like to reset your password?
Oh, yeah.
Well, actually, wait, before we get to this part, because this is a big part, I do want to ask you quickly which version of the orgy you watched, because
that's
this was a big deal when it came out. Yeah. Did you see the ones with the CGI people blocking the genitals?
I don't think so.
Or did you watch the uncut version?
I feel like I saw genitals.
I heard about the CGI people. I wanted to see the CGI people, but I think we saw, like, maybe they were blocked a little bit. But
I watched it on Crave, and definitely, like, every single time there was a vigorous sex scene, there was like an awkward green screened in person in a black robe, like,
yeah. Okay,
very clearly so blocking it.
I watched it on Crave, too. I have it on DVD, so, like, what I'm used to is the uncut version that was released in Europe. But I'm actually glad that I watched it on Crave, because I was just too lazy to hook up the DVD player. Because, because I hadn't seen that, like, since the 90s, probably. And, it's terrible. It's I don't know why that's the version on Crave, but, like, yeah, basically after Kubrick died, they had the MPAA said it was going to be rated NC-17 because of those orgy scenes. And the kind of compromise they came up with was to censor it by CGIing in these people just kind of blocking your view. I remember Ebert at the time referred to it as like the Austin Powers thing, because they're just like conveniently placed to, to block out some of the
that's hilarious.
They don't even really block out anything. You couldn't really see it, but you could see a bit more of like the thrusting, I guess. I don't know, you guys watched it.
Honestly, by that point, like, nudity had been totally de-eroticized for me, you know, so they could have totally had the genitals and, you know, it wouldn't even have been noticed, because there's just so much nudity in this movie. You're like, yeah, you might be turned on for like the first 5 minutes, but I can't sustain that sort of, not me.
Well, I don't think it's supposed to be necessarily like an erotic scene. I think that's partly why people, you know, people were sold on this movie. It's like, this is the movie where Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman fuck, and they just got like the scene with the most sex in it is like a horror movie. Like,
yeah.
It's not,
yeah.
Pleasant.
And there's like so much tension in the movie of this like promise of sex that's never delivered, that like I think you kind of need to get a real weird eyeful in this sequence as even a kind of like an upsetting release. To not get it is just like extremely frustrating. Even though it's not really
cinematic blue balls.
Yeah.
That's the other reason why I think this movie is really funny. It's just like, it's funny to me that they cast like one of the biggest like sex symbols of the 90s in this sex filled movie. And every time he's about to have sex with someone, like the phone rings or something. Like, again, it's dream logic. Like, it's very dreamlike, but it's also just absurd and comic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, so what happens is they find him out, and this woman, she ends up sort of sacrificing herself for him, because they are going to murder his ass, because I guess you just don't come uninvited to an orgy. It's bad form. It's not cool. Even though everybody's wearing masks and cloaks, so it's not like you can say, hey, I saw Tom there, you know? I mean, everyone can say they saw Tom there because he has to take off his mask. But any other Toms, they're fine.
Tom Hanks was there. No one knows.
Tom Hanks was there. Yeah. He
That's how he got COVID. He wasn't wearing a mask.
Yeah, this movie is very pro, you know, it's a good movie to watch during COVID because, yeah, everyone is wearing masks. And
I found funny was that they would, like, kiss each other with the masks on. And then there's a lot of scenes where, like, this guy.
You got to do that these days.
Is between this woman's legs, like, obviously giving her cunnilingus. But he has the mask on. So I'm just like, well.
It doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
But like, sometimes the mask has a little hole in the mouth. Anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. It could have been a Gene Simmons mask.
There you go.
But.
Yeah, I would have liked just to see, like, what, like, all the, they've all got these kind of, like, artful, like, old timey Harlequin mask. It would have been funny if there's just, like, one Nixon mask or something. Yeah.
It's like, why is everyone going in the room with Pinocchio mask over there? Like, anyway.
It's the only one the store had.
It's like a Don Post Darth Vader mask.
But then, so, yeah, he's allowed to go free, and it's sort of fine, but he goes, and then the next day, he wants to find out what happened. So he starts sort of investigating. He tries to find Nick Nightingale, but Nick Nightingale has left town all of a sudden. He's gone back to wherever.
And it's Alan Cumming.
Alan Cumming.
Oh,
yeah,
my God.
He's the best part of this movie for me. I loved that character. I loved him. And
it's a really good performance by him, and he's great in everything, but he really nailed it in this.
As you got another person who wants to fuck Tom Cruise but won't.
Yeah.
He came in this morning about 4:30 a.m. with two men. Big guys. I mean, they were very well dressed and very well spoken, but they weren't the kind of people you'd like to fool around with, if you know what I mean. Anyways, I noticed Mr. Nightingale had a bruise on his cheek, and to be perfectly honest, I also thought he looked a little scared.
Yeah, that's the thing I remember people saying at the time too, like, it's that's adds to, like, the weird tone of the movie. It's like almost every single character Tom Cruise meets relates to him sexually, even like the, like, hooligans on the street who, like, harass him.
Like,
they call him, like, gay and stuff. They're like gay bashing, but then they're also like, wait, you want to fuck me? It's like, wait, that's a good turn. But yeah, Alan Cumming is so great. I watched he introduced the movie at TIFF a few years ago.
Nice.
When they had the Kubrick exhibit, and his intro is online, so I watched it today, and it was very funny.
You interviewed him, right, Johnny?
Watch it.
I did. I interviewed him for Extra several years ago.
Did he talk about this movie at all?
I think we talked kind of generally about what a varied film career he has had, and what a mix of high and low brow, of which this is a great example of something that is both.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Amazing. And he also goes to try to see the prostitute that he almost had sex with, but she's not there. Oh, and he also, he sees in the newspaper that the woman that he saved from overdosing has died. And so he tries to go and see her. And he does see her in the morgue, and she's very naked, and he almost has a Molly Parker from Kissed moment.
Yeah, I love that the orderly is standing like 2 feet from him, and he's just watching Tom Cruise slowly lean down to kiss this dead woman. And I'm
this,
like,
isn't the first time he's taken a bribe.
Oh God.
Ooh.
Well, I remember that was one of the, like, before people knew what this movie was about, and there was maybe just that teaser trailer or, like, some on-set leaks. Like, one of the things was, like, Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman are having sex. There's an orgy. There's necrophilia. Like, And it's really like a pretty innocuous scene.
Somebody say necrophilia?
Who's that? Is that Molly Parker?
It is. She has a low voice.
You've been smoking a lot, Molly Parker. You've been smoking a lot.
That's all there is to do in Deadwood, the show she's in. And he also tells Nicole Kidman about everything that happened during his crazy night, his dark night of the soul. And
well, that's at the end, at the very
oh,
end.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I mean, okay. But, okay, more stuff happens.
And he
goes to see Sidney Pollan.
Well, he goes back to the place where the party was, and they give him a note telling him to stop investigating. So it really seems like they will get him. And then he goes to see Sidney Pollack, and Sidney Pollack's like, I don't know if this will surprise you, but I was one of the guys at the orgy. I know. I mean, you saw me with that sex worker not 24 hours earlier, but I needed to go to this orgy. I'm an old man. I'm making up for lost time.
I was the one with the suspenders and no shirt.
When you wear suspenders, your pants rub against your crotch. It gets you very aroused. It's a thing.
But I love the scene because Sidney Pollack is great. And I love it because this movie is so about like Tom Cruise is just like complete uselessness. And like, even when he's like playing like investigator and like uncovering this conspiracy, like he kind of gets hauled into like the principal's office and talked down to by Sidney Pollack, and who basically like tells him like, oh, there was like, we didn't even kill that person. It's like, yeah, we roughed up Nick Nightingale and sent him home because, you know, he shouldn't have told you about, our orgy. Like, I mean, even after all, he does all this sleuthing and it seems like things are getting so creepy, he ultimately like can't even, you know, reach the climax of the movie. Like, it's another like climax. Moment of impotence for Tom Cruise. So I love that. And Sidney Pollack is just so good.
He is. Yeah, he's a very commanding actor. Was. He's passed away. Yeah, and there's a number of directors in this movie, too. The guy who plays Nick Nightingale is also a film director.
Yeah, Todd Field.
Yeah, and he makes his movies sound kind of horny, too. I wonder if that's why Stanley Kubrick got him in there.
He's good, too.
Yeah. He's really good, yeah. And I didn't recognize him, so yeah, I looked him up, and I was like, yeah, he's a very good performer in that role. And then he goes back home and he tells Nicole Kidman about everything in a big sort of weeping mess. And, I mean, she's obviously hurt. And
well, after uncovering the mask, though.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, so, yeah, that's right. It's not as if he came out with everything because he was feeling guilty. He was caught. That's what happened, you know. Shame on you, Tom Cruise.
Though, I mean, it's not like he was caught. I feel like that's largely symbolic. It's not like you would find a mask and be like, oh, you must have been in one of those all-night orgies I heard about on 60 Minutes. Like,
or doing Commedia dell'arte.
Yeah.
Were you Pantalone?
Either one's a violation of our marriage.
I just saw that as like, you know, this night he had is like inescapable. It's in his home. Mm. Like he needs to confront it. I don't know. That it's from the book and it was written 100 years ago. Who knows?
But then they have to go Christmas shopping with their daughter and they have to play the happy family. And it's a big question about whether or not they will be able to continue as a couple, as a family. And she's like, yeah, but we got to do one thing. Get
go see
Ricky.
A marriage counselor. Oh no! Okay, right. Yeah, that. Yeah, the fantasy continues.
It feels
the dream
like
is not over.
You're watching Nicole Kidman break up with Tom Cruise in real time in that scene, though, right?
Kind of. I mean, there is that because I don't know exactly what the timeline is, but yeah, my history
didn't last
is
much longer than this movie.
Yeah, no.
No,
I feel like they got married for the marketing for this movie. I feel like they were like, yeah, let's do it for the movie.
Well, how long were they married for?
No, they were married for a while. Before.
They had two kids.
Other movies together too, right? Like Days of Thunder.
Yeah, Far and Away.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Checks out.
That was like
this wasn't their first trip around the block.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I love that last scene. I think that scene's really good. And the scene before that, like where it's right after he's told her the whole story and like she just looks like crap and she's, you know, smoking and, I mean, reacting like how any of us would react to hearing that story condensed into 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Helen is going to be up soon. She's, she's expecting us to take her Christmas shopping today.
Yeah.
And they go Christmas shopping again. Christmas.
There you go.
And I, that's where I think it is like a Christmas movie because it is about the family coming together at the end and choosing family over whatever else, you know, over this sort of ideal that you had of your marriage, over, you know, the ideal of monogamy or whatever, or whatever, being over trust, you know. Mm-hmm. They decide, you know, we have to keep the family unit together, which is, I mean, what Christmas traditionally is kind of sort of about.
Yeah,
something like that.
I mean, no, I mean, it's true. The like my mom worked in shelters and stuff, and there's for teens, and they always have beds at Christmas because teens go home, you know. Christmas does really bring people together, although
I think there's
no go on.
Oh,
that's a sadder Christmas thing than the end of this Christmas movie.
Yeah.
Well, I think there's something in this movie. Christmas, I think, plays into it in terms. I'm not totally sure how I feel about how Christmas is represented in this movie because I think it's complicated. And in that scene, when he comes home just before he sees the mask, he turns off the Christmas lights on the tree for the first time. And I feel like that's significant. I don't know if this is, I don't have a universal theory on what the sort of Christmas lights represent, but if I were to guess, I'd say I think they kind of represent a feeling or an idea of like home or of security. And just like a projected kind of like, this is what you want your life or your home to be. Like we see it in so many of these places that are, you know, safe or friendly, or, you know, I mean, they go to, when they go to Sidney Pollack's house the first time, like it's just covered in Christmas lights, like, but he's projecting so hard this, you know, this vision of himself. And, you know, it turns out to be this total dirtbag. But I mean, even like when Tom Cruise goes to, the girl from Hocus Pocus,
that's
the sex worker's, apartment, like, he goes back to her apartment and she has like Christmas lights, and it becomes quite intimate because in a big way because of those Christmas decorations, like not just the lights, but like the Christmas cards and the presents like stacked in the sink. So I think there is something about like, you know, about creating this identity for yourself and this identity for yourself as like, you know, in terms of your home and like the space where you live. And I think that moment where he turns off the Christmas lights and then sees that space violated by the mask kind of speaks to that. Again, I don't know. I'm just trying to figure out how it all fits together. But, and again, like I said before, like there are no Christmas decorations in the orgy. Like that's a place where everyone is completely anonymous. There's no personality there. There's no projecting, you know, who you are or who your family is or what you want to be. That's where people just go to have these like anonymous satanic orgies, not to,
it's like Narnia, always winter and never Christmas.
Right.
I kind of thought Christmas was sex. That it's all like, cause I feel like they sort of exist in the same way of this kind of like, and I think in a way, especially bringing up sort of the Christmas shopping, which is not what I would ever call Christmas shopping. Like they're just taking their child to look at a store for things that she wants for later. Right. Like they're
just
not
going
to,
like, buying FAO shorts. Yeah.
They're not actually buying anything. They're just like looking for things that they want.
Well, I think it is for Christmas because she says like, oh, I want Santa to bring me one of these. And it's like, okay. Totally. And I think that's what parents do. Cause I remember my parents used to take me to like Toys R Us to like look for what Santa, mm-hmm. what I wanted Santa to bring. And I'd go and be like, I want this. And they're like, you sure? And like, yeah. And then we'd all get in the car.
Eyes wide shut.
Oh, you're Yeah, no. And then they'd be like, oh, your dad has to use the bathroom. And my dad would go back in. And I realized later that he was going to buy the toys so he didn't have to make a second trip. Like, so I think
But I think in a way, using like a child's desire for Christmas presents is kind of this like perfect metaphor for the way that sex works in this movie, where it's all about anticipation and want, and that the actual result is often like not as good as the buildup, or even not existent, like you didn't get the thing that you asked for. And even just like chronologically, this film's relationship to Christmas I find super confusing, where it seems always on the brink of Christmas, but no one ever locates, like no one ever says like it's Christmas
Santa
Eve
never
tomorrow.
Comes.
Yeah. It's true. Like even by the
that
end
was
of the
a
movie,
double entendre.
It's like it's Christmas next week. Is it tomorrow? Like it's never Christmas in this movie. Mm-hmm. It's always like Christmas season. It's never the day.
What a nightmare!
Yeah,
it's the happiest place I could imagine.
It's the most wonderful time of the year.
Yeah,
that's also the same scene where their daughter gets secretly kidnapped. Did you guys notice that? Okay, that's another thing we should talk about is there are a lot of conspiracy theories
about a Kubrick movie,
which we'll talk about.
Impossible.
We'll talk about that and more after this break. We'll be right back.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Okay, we're back. We're talking about Eyes Wide Shut here on Rewatchability, the holiday favorite. One thing I forgot to mention at the top of the show is I wanted to thank all of our Patreon donors. Those are the people that give a few bucks a month to help keep the Christmas lights on all the time.
Except when we're having the orgy.
Yeah, turn them off. We take them away. So, Eyes Wide Shut, I didn't really prepare any proper trivia questions for you guys, but you also seem to not know a lot about this movie because you haven't seen it, Blaine and Rob. Johnny, I don't know if you'll know this, but I avoided talking about some things when Rob was doing his rundown, so I could ask you about it. Do you know who played Sidney Pollack's part originally? Because Kubrick famously does a ton of reshoots, so there were a few actors that didn't come back for reshoots that he had to recast. So Sidney Pollack, who do you think played his part originally?
Oh my God, I do, or like I did know this, because they like, even like, didn't he like shot it with somebody else in that role and somebody else as the woman whose father died, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
No, I can't remember who either of them are, but there are other David notable actors.
Schwimmer.
They're big actors. Big,
I saw it on David the Schwimmer. IMDb, and I think even though I saw it that way, I should get the points.
Snatch
okay,
him.
Who is it, Rob?
It's Harvey Keitel.
That's right. And do you know who played the woman who's married to Greg?
Harvey Keitel again.
It's Harvey Keitel again.
It's not
again.
Jenna Elfman. no, it's... Do you remember, Johnny?
I don't. Again, I don't.
Okay, it's Jennifer Jason Leigh.
Oh, right, yeah, and she had to... This is what I read in the IMDb, so it's not as if I'm pulling this from my memory, except for my memory from like 30 minutes
short-term
ago.
Short-term memory, yeah.
Yeah, but she had to leave to do Existence, the David Cronenberg
movie. That's
right, yeah,
movie, exactly.
Which I love, but also too bad she's not in this movie.
Mm. I was also, when I was listening to that Alan Cumming thing, he was talking about how he didn't know if he'd be in the finished movie because they asked him to come back for reshoots and he couldn't do it. And he said he was friends with Jennifer Jason Leigh, who he knew had been cut out and replaced. So he thought the same thing happened to him. But no, they kept the Alan Cumming scene, even though he didn't come back. And Sidney Pollack, incidentally, was replaced. It's funny because Sidney Pollack had recommended Tom Cruise to Kubrick like years before they made this movie. I think when Kubrick was wondering about who to cast, he asked Sidney Pollack, who directed Tom Cruise in The Firm, about working with him. And Sidney Pollack said, you know, he's really great to work with. And then when it came time to replacing Harvey Keitel, Tom Cruise recommended Sidney Pollack.
Wow. Nice.
One good turn.
One thing I've always thought was interesting is, so Kubrick tried to make this movie for years. He bought the rights in like 1970 or something. And I remember reading that like he was going to make it like a year or two after getting married for the first time, but it's all about like, you know, marriage and jealousy. And his wife was like, maybe just wait a few years until we've been married a little longer before you make
destroy this. Someone else's marriage with this movie.
But at one point in like the '70s, he was going to make this as kind of like an absurd art house movie starring, not Sidney Pollack, but another famous director,
Steven Spielberg.
Do you know who that was?
Yeah.
No.
Woody Allen.
Yes, it was Woody Allen.
Wow.
His second choice was Roman Polanski. No, yeah. that part's not true. But yeah, Woody Allen. Can you imagine that version?
Amazing.
I have a weird piece of trivia about this movie.
Okay.
Okay, so I feel like one of the sort of interesting, I think, parts of the film, you know, you have the whole orgy mask sequence. And because of the masks, I feel like there are certain questions that you have, especially when Sidney Pollack comes up later, and it's like, oh, he says he was there. Is it possible that he was the master of ceremonies? Is it possible that that person who nods to him from the balcony was him recognizing him? And then also, there's the whole mystery throughout the film of sort of like, okay, so there's that woman who recognizes him. We assume it's probably Mandy. By the end of the movie, he's sort of like, was that Mandy? And Sidney Pollack's like, yeah, it totally was. And then it comes out, if you look at the credits for the movie, one person is listed as Mandy, and one person is credited as Mystery Woman. It is not the same actor playing those two roles. No. I feel like, which is a very notable choice, because in both sequences, in every sequence, in the morgue, in the bathroom, and at the orgy,
she's naked.
She's completely nude, and the camera is just looking at her body nonstop. It's not the same body. So It feels pretty intentional to use a different actor. Beyond that, it is not the actor who provides the body of the Mystery Woman who provides the voice of the Mystery Woman. So you may notice
this. I do know, yeah,
that it's that there is something very, I think, dreamy about every time the Mystery Woman speaks, and it was in fact recorded later. And who is the voice of the Mystery Woman?
Do you know this, JM?
I do.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
I also saw it on the IMDb trivia.
I go into this fresh, naked as the day I was born.
This was a fairly recent revelation, too. I kept this quiet for a while.
Until last year.
Mm.
Tippi Hedren. Who was it?
It was Cate Blanchett.
Oh, cool. I like
wow.
Her.
Yeah, you can totally tell it's her, too. Like, she does sound like Cate Blanchett when you watch it.
Hmm.
Yeah, nice. It's a very striking and notable voice.
That's a good piece of trivia, Johnny.
It's not the voice that you sort of hear like mumbling out of Mandy in her earlier scene at all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's kind of an interesting disunity there.
Maybe that's part of like the dream thing, and like there's like an interchangeability of, I mean, like, all the women in this movie are sort of interchangeable in a way, and they're also vaguely resemble Nicole Kidman, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, not quite as, it was more overtly surreal, but like in Buñuel's last film, he cast two women to play the same part and then overdubbed them with a third. So it's not, you know, without some precedent.
Yeah.
I do want to say about the theory about Ziegler being the guy in the red suit, who's kind of like the ringleader. That theory, I think, stems from the fact that when Sidney Pollack is talking to Tom Cruise in the billiards room, he kind of like taps the billiard ball against the table two times in the same way that the man with the gold mask and the red cloak taps his like staff or whatever during that weird ritual when Tom Cruise first gets there. So, I mean, I don't know. I kind of see him more as like the other guy you mentioned, the guy with like the tricorn hat, if anything. And the guy who plays the guy with the red cloak and the gold mask is Leon Vitali, who they just made a documentary about a few years ago, who is Kubrick's longtime assistant. Right. And I mean, assistant is, not, it's an understatement, I guess, because he did a lot of work on these movies. He gets a credit right at the top, at the end credits. I don't know if you noticed that, because he did so much, not just during the making of the movie, but once Kubrick died, he was tasked with doing a lot of stuff to finish the post-production of the movie because it wasn't quite finished. Mm-hmm. And he was an actor. So like he met Kubrick making Barry Lyndon. He was like an up and coming actor who, if you watch the documentary Film Worker, it's great because it talks about how he just became kind of infatuated with the filmmaking process and wanted to work with Kubrick and kind of got drawn into this, this obsessive, hard to deal with person's life and career. But he, contributed so much to the work. And then it's nice that after doing all of that work and kind of giving up his promising acting career, that he got this juicy part in the end to play that character. I think he actually said he's like four or five of the people in cloaks in that scene.
That's funny.
So I don't know if I totally buy that theory. There are a lot of crazy conspiracy theories about this movie. Like I was mentioning, the one I alluded to before the commercial break was people say they see two of the extras in the toy store scene at the end are extras who were also in the party scene at the beginning.
Okay.
And the simplest explanation to that would be that they merely reused the same extras.
That doesn't happen. Filming the movie.
Some people think that Tom Cruise is still being followed by Ziegler's people, and that when Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman have that kind of long scene where it's, just close-ups of the two of them and you don't see their daughter for a long time, their daughter is being kidnapped by those, those goons that run those cults and, scooped up for some kind of child sex ring. That's the other thing is this whole, there's also like a whole faction of people that believe that, like the Pizzagate people believe that this movie was like some people think that Stanley Kubrick was killed because of this movie.
Wow.
And because of 24 extra minutes that were cut out of the movie for the theatrical release.
Not because of the moon landing?
No. He skated by on that one. But it was the 24 minutes of Eyes Wide Shut that were cut out that I guess were more explicit in like incriminating certain people. I mean, I'd like to tell you that Jeffrey Epstein isn't involved, but there's also like a conspiracy involving the guy who broke the news of Epstein's death is like the guy who wrote the New York Post article in this movie that talks about the beauty queen who died. I mean, there's no end to the conspiracy in this movie, but I would like to say in terms of like they killed Kubrick over it, like from all accounts, he was in poor health while making this. Like he was old. It was exhausting. He was like on supplemental oxygen and refused to go to a doctor. So I don't think it was the work of an assassin.
Or the assassin didn't have to work very hard.
Yeah, an assassin exactly. Called time.
Yeah. The assassin of us all.
My personal favorite conspiracy theory about this movie, though, is because you guys know, like, the shooting of this movie went on for like a crazy long time. Like we said, they replaced actors with scenes that were already shot just because they couldn't come back and do reshoots. You know, there's a famous story of like Tom Cruise had to come through a door 100 times, like, you know, because he was a perfectionist and he was always tinkering with his stuff. But there, I did read a theory. I can't remember where it was, but this is true that Kubrick's daughter Vivian became a Scientologist and cut off her whole family, and now I think she's become like a real like alt-right like Alex Jones supporter type person. Yeah, but at the time she joined Scientology, and now I've later learned that the family may have found out about that after the making of Eyes Wide Shut. But I remember reading a theory that because that was around the time it was happening, not that Tom Cruise had anything to do with it, but that because it was happening simultaneously, Kubrick was punishing Tom Cruise with all of these excessive takes.
That's kind of funny.
Because he was so associated with the church. So that's why they had him like on a treadmill walking in front of a rear projection screen for like weeks on end, just some kind of punishment for his daughter joining Scientology.
Wow.
Anyways. That's a fun one. Wow. Yeah. So that's that.
I have a weird trivia question for you guys. I don't know if you'll be able to get this, but the book that this is based off of is by a guy named Arthur Schnitzler, who his other best known work, can you guys name his other best known work?
La Ronde.
Holy shit, it is. It's my literal last name.
Whoa.
And it's also a crazy horny play. All of his plays are like super horny.
Know where you get it.
Yeah.
And it was adapted into that play The Blue Room, starring Nicole Kidman.
Whoa.
On Broadway. Whoa. That was that everyone, do you remember everyone wanted to like buy tickets to specific seats because she was fully nude in that play?
And right. It was
like, from seat G13, you can see her derriere, man. Like it was
just watch Eyes Wide Shut. Way to bring us full circle, or La Ronde.
Well, you know, it is funny to look at the book, though, like the original book, because it's very, you know, kind of like its time and kind of stilted and very dated. But it's the movie, like the flow of the book, like the arrangement of scenes and the events that play out. Are the movie. That's what's so funny about people that are like, the Illuminati had Kubrick killed. It's like, he based it on a book that came out 80 years before. Like, it's all there. Like, it's funny how close an adaptation it actually is.
Did you've read the book?
Yeah, I read it in high school.
Just part of your
someone
like
say something.
Part of your exploration of erotic fiction.
We're all just... No, I read it because of the movie. Because they sold a like a paperback that was like I think it was like half the screenplay and half the original. It's very short. It's a novella,
right?
So, yeah. and there was also a book I remember I also read in high school. The co-writer of the movie, Frederick Raphael. My favorite of the Ninja Turtles, wrote a book about his time writing this with Kubrick, and he kind of painted him in a negative light at sometimes. And I know like the Kubrick family really came out against the book, and he presented like a lot of conversations between the two as just like straight up screenplay dialogue conversations that, you know, he would have no way of knowing unless he recorded the conversations, which I don't think he did. So I the accuracy of the book was certainly debated, but I mean, it's interesting to read, to at least get one of the co-writers' kind of creative accounts of what went into making it.
Mm-hmm.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you guys didn't like this movie, or Blaine didn't. I mean, I get it. I get it. What specifically didn't you like?
Well, if we're going to do the whole let's go around the table and say if it's rewatchable or not, I felt that I can buy into the dream logic. There's a lot of dream logic-y movies out there, but this felt like it had a foot in reality or was trying to. And it was just so strange at times that instead of sucking me in, it kind of pushed me out. so many jokes to be made here off of these horrible words I'm using. But the, like, I just felt like it was alienating, and I couldn't get into it. And I like Stanley Kubrick's other movie. Like, when The Shining does it, I'm like, oh my God, that's great, because it's a horror movie. And it's, but this didn't feel like that. It felt like it was confused as to what it wanted to be, that it was striking out at certain times to do these things that didn't really come together for me. And the fact that just, it was a long movie to begin with, and then everyone, like, Tom Cruise repeated every line that everyone said to him. I was like,
he repeated every line that everyone said to him?
Yeah. Put a bullet.
He repeated every line that everyone said to him.
And so there was times where, you know, like, Johnny, you watched this with your husband, and he brought the phone out, you told me, and I was like, yeah, I was like itching at my pocket, being like, I want to go on Reddit. Like, it was hard to get through for me. So maybe I wasn't in the right frame of mind for it. Or
I think it also helps to watch theatrically, to be honest. Like, I mean, it's a movie you have to kind of fall into the rhythm of. And I think that's a big reason. Like, I don't think you're alone. I think that's a big reason why people didn't like it when it came out, because it is slow. It is odd. But I think, like, if you can kind of get on its wavelength, like, it becomes very hypnotic. And I think, like those weird dialogue beats you're talking about, like, are a part of that. Like, it's the pace. It's the rhythm.
But it never seemed uniform. To me, you know, they dipped in and out of it, and there were certain actors, like, you know, director Suspenders over there that, like, acted really, like, naturalistically. I felt like he did a great job. And then the sex worker's friend, who was also a sex worker, you know, she acted very naturalistically. There was, like, a lot of parts that I felt were like, oh, this is something else. This is from another movie that's put into this. And so it just felt.
But I think that works with dreams, though. That's what dreams are like. It's like something will be super crazy or weird, but you don't feel like you're in a dream in it in the moment. Like, some moments of dreams can feel very real.
Totally. But yeah, but there's no cohesiveness to it. And in terms of, like, dream logic, like, it felt video game-ish at a time, where he was sent on these side quests to do these things. Like, you have to return the jacket now, and he'd go to the jacket, and they're like,
well, he had
now
to return to press, the jacket.
Hey, now I need to press the number to do this, and I need to get this and that. And that all was very, very logical. And there was no dream logic to the shoe leather between scenes, which I would assume would be in a movie that's about dream logic, where he kind of, like, shows up at a place and you're not sure how he got there, but he's there. You know, there's so many different elements to a movie, and the dream logic was in certain elements, but not others. So that just made me it pulled me out. That's kind of where, so I don't think it's that rewatchable, and I'll probably never see it again. But
I think you should. See, I think it is one of those movies that you might get a lot from on a second viewing.
Yes.
Watch
Maybe
it after
I
an orgy.
Would. I might smoke some weed. What was it? Sativa? I should smoke instead of...
Just go into Nicole Kidman's medicine cabinet, open up the Band-Aid box.
I don't want to take what she was taking. I don't want to. I'll get so angry. It'll be awful. No. But what about you, Rob? You hadn't seen it before. What do you think about this movie?
Yeah.
Do you think it's rewatchable?
I mean, I have to admit, I didn't love it watching it this time. I think that there's a lot that I didn't really get. And I think, personally, JM saying, like, that has it's dreamlike, or it's supposed to be dreamlike, that sort of keyed in a lot for me. Like, yeah, like, some of the choices that are made in the performance feel dreamlike. Some of the logic in the plot is dreamlike. And even, like, the way that everybody comes on to Tom Cruise is dreamlike. Though that might happen, I guess, maybe in real life. He is a movie star. But for me, I think it's a really interesting movie. I don't understand everything, but I do know that I like movies about you know, strained relationships. And I feel like Nicole Kidman and Tom Cruise's characters are sort of interesting. And I think that it's an interesting journey that his character takes. And, you know, it's sort of like a journey into like the grimy part of our soul, I guess, because it's a bit of a fantasy about being a bad person, you know, where you go to an orgy and, you know, go to a prostitute and your wife's at home, you know, watching your kid, right? Mm-hmm. And, yeah, I mean, I just think there's a lot of interesting stuff there. I didn't love it, but I would definitely rewatch it again. And I'm sure that I would get something else from it. It's weird. It's stilted. There are parts that I don't think that I understand, but I think it all sort of adds up to something that is interesting, at least for me. So I think I would probably want to watch it again to get a better handle on it. What about you? What about you, Johnny?
It's I feel like it's a really complicated one for me. I was very interested to watch it again, having seen it before, partly just to get through all of the context around the movie, because I just feel like there's so much baggage that it brings to it, like being this movie that like Kubrick dies as he's cutting and the legacy of that, being this thing that was this like document of Tom and Nicole at sort of nearing the end of their marriage, that it promised us through the marketing campaign, this erotic thriller, that it was going to be like their body heat or something. And then it just so absolutely wasn't that. And people were so mad at it. And I think partly because like they wanted to see Tom and Nicole bang. Did I say Tom and Nicole? You wanted to see them bang and you like, didn't get
a bone time. Really,
that was really frustrating for people. And it's got all this baggage. And I was like, what is the movie underneath all of that? And there is something really interesting to it. I mean, I think like all of Kubrick's movies, like there's so much intentionality and you know that, you know, he's going to recast actors after principal photography is done and he's going to make people do a million takes, and that you're sort of like, yeah, if those extras were in the very first and the very last scene of the movie, that doesn't seem like something a person like that would sign off on unintentionally. And it's interesting. And even all of the sort of the ambiguity around the mystery woman and the various different performers playing her is intriguing to me. And then, and you're sort of like, the story that Sidney Pollack tells Tom Cruise, you're like, is Nick Nightingale alive and in Seattle, or is he totally like dead at the bottom of the river at the end of this movie? Like, we really don't know, and either could be true. Was the mystery woman even Mandy? I don't know. Maybe it was a whole other woman. Like, maybe it was. That's all kind of fascinating to me. And there was, and I don't know, like the music.
Oh, the music!
The music is very hypnotic.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like the fact that it was not actually filmed on location at all. And there's this kind of staginess to this New York, this kind of falseness and emptiness to it that gives you this sense of unease. And I mean, the masked orgy sequence, I feel like, is just so iconic. It's such a part of culture. It's become like people say Eyes Wide Shut if they mean, you know, that that's become just like a byword for like masked kinky rich people thing, right? Like,
yeah.
If you say you're having an Eyes Wide Shut party, you're having an orgy, you know, bring your cloak, your mask. It's
been parodied. It's everybody, even if you haven't seen the movie, you know what that is. Like, it's so embedded in pop culture.
It's even just like not even parodied, like movies take from it all the time. Like what was the last Daniel Craig James Bond movie? Had a whole sequence that just totally cribbed shots from
The Lovebirds too. Just did that as well.
And that was more parody, but yeah, totally. I mean, yeah,
it's still being parodied is what I'm saying.
I think that like What's hard for me, though, is that, like, even I'm so fascinated by this movie that I really want to love it. I want it to be this total, like, unappreciated gem. And I don't know that I do totally love it. And especially, I found on a rewatch, there were parts of it that kind of stuck out like sore thumbs to me. Whereas, like, some of these Nicole Kidman monologues are, like, really kind of borderline embarrassing to me. Like, I just feel like, and I don't think it's, I think she's an amazing actor, and I think she is doing exactly to a T what she has been directed to do. I don't know that all of those choices are doing her any favors. There's things like all of the stuff going on with Lily Sobieski as, like, an underage sex worker whose father's in on it. And I would say, like, what we can pretty much call, like, a racist portrayal of Asian men who are into underage girls and cross-dressing, that I was like, this feels extremely tasteless and kind of gross. The kind of the body fascism of the movie and the sexism of the movie, that it's like all about sex and we really just see the exact same body type over and over again, and it's always a woman and she's always naked and they feel completely interchangeable. And that even, like, finally, when the master ceremonies is like, Tom Cruise, you need to get naked now. And you're sort of like, this movie, he should. This movie deserves for Tom Cruise to be fully naked right now. And then they're like, no. A naked woman is going to put a stop to this. And it's like, oh, God damn it. Like, it's just the same thing that you're giving us over and over and over again in this movie. And then there's just, I don't know. And I feel like there's also, like, the representation of queer people in the movie feels like it was, like, I bet it felt so transgressive in 1999 to, like, have Tom Cruise be gay bashed and to have, like, a couple of, like, men dancing with men at the orgy. And, like, it was literally, like, one man dancing with a man, one woman dancing with a woman. And sort of like, oh, yeah, and that's as freaky as these rich fucks get. Otherwise, it's just missionary sex and masks with people who look exactly the same. Like, I don't know, it's like, have you ever, like, been to an orgy? There's more shit than this going on at those kind of events, even if you're poor, let alone if you're, like, these rich people running the planet.
Yeah, I honestly, I don't know how that doesn't get boring after 8 minutes.
And then even just the whole setup of, like, this huge sort of personal crisis over the reveal that your wife thought about having sex with somebody else one time, even just, like, within cinema,
crisis of masculinity.
I think it's just, like, we've all seen movies from, like, British and from European directors from decades earlier that I feel like sorted this out and went so much further in terms of, like, sexual content, in terms of being, like, yeah, like, this whole, like, heteronormativity and monogamy is kind of bullshit, and this whole story that you've been sold is a lie. And then it just seems like it's so shocking for these people, and just, like, the crazy havoc that it wreaks is just like, oh, like, the straights are not okay. Not okay.
But I think it also is, like, I think it is also more powerful in this movie, or more significant in this movie than some of the other things we've seen in the past, partly because of the iconography we've been talking about, of it being Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman, like Hollywood's it couple, like having this, like, existential crisis over their relationship. I don't think is insignificant.
This was the end of marriage in America, let's be honest.
It's maybe the end of the erotic thriller.
Well, that's definitely.
Yeah.
Sure. I also, yeah, totally. The moment where Domino's roommate reveals to Tom Cruise that she's had a blood test and is HIV positive is almost, I found watching that moment in this year, it rubbed me so the wrong way. And I was just like, I don't fucking buy for a second that this, like, woman who's, like, they're both sex workers, they're friends, she has just found out her roommate's HIV status, and she's going to just, like, casually let it slip to some John. Like, no fucking way. But I mean,
I also felt like yeah, the reactions to that were so weird too. I guess that feeds into the dream logic.
It only works in the context of dream logic and of the idea that like what we're seeing is the sexual fears and fantasies of this extremely privileged straight white man, and like his that it's just like, oh my god, what if you had sex and your wife found out? What if your wife had sex yeah. with someone else? What if you had sex and you got HIV? What if someone thought you were gay and they beat you up? Like, it's just all
it's part
of
like the nightmare. It's not really, it doesn't reflect reality at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I will say in terms of like the privilege of it, I am so sick of movies and TV shows about like super rich Manhattan white people, you know, living their best lives, but having some small problem that they need to deal with. But I think here it is very intentional because like the sort of problems that our characters having are so abstract and like insubstantial. Like he's having a crisis over like just an abstract thought his wife had, nothing she's actually done. Like I remember I listened to an interview that Kubrick's wife Christiane gave, and I actually saw her introduce Eyes Wide Shut a few years ago too. She talked about how like that was very purposeful because like it was important for them to start the movie with this couple having essentially no problems. Like they're good looking, they have all the money in the world, and they seem to be happy, and they're even like basically both propositioned at that party they go to and like refuse to do anything about it. So they're like essentially like happily monogamous, like, but they don't have governance over each other's thoughts or desires or yeah, like inner lives. And that's what kind of sends Tom Cruise spiraling out of control. And so I think that it's not a story that you see done that much. And I think it is almost about like the I think it's about like the sort of impotence and embarrassing qualities of like the straight white rich movie star like characters that we see in movies. Like the Tom Cruise character is ineffective for the entire movie, and like his moment of, you know, he ends the movie basically crying in his wife's arms because he did a bunch of stupid shit for almost no reason. Like, I don't know. I think that's what the movie is supposed to be. It's almost like a deconstruction of that character.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, it's funny. Like, there was a lot about the movie that I was like, I feel the criticisms of this, I'm not fully in love with this movie, but I do feel, I could see myself watching it again. And I was sort of reminded of something that there was a documentary about another failed 90s erotic thriller, Showgirls, where one of the things they said in it was like, oh, we still watch this movie because we're not done with it yet. And this feels like another movie where I'm like, oh, yeah, I don't know if I'm like totally done with this movie.
Mm-hmm.
But that said, I think for me, it is super overshadowed in my imagination by a movie like Mulholland Drive, which I think goes to so many of the same places as this movie, but has such a more fun time doing it. And that it's like, you want to go to like a weird club with a kind of Italian secret password. We've got it. But you yeah. will not be bored for a second.
Yeah, no one does also dream logic like David Lynch, obviously.
Yeah, that it's like, if I want dream logic, give me like the Dumpster Man and the Blue Box and the Cowboy.
Oh my god,
and
the Dumpster Man.
The Dumpster Man was a woman.
Dumpster Woman! I could never get a boner again. It's
the same woman who plays like the nun in the Conjuring movies.
Oh. Yeah. Fun fact.
Yeah.
Fun fact. All right, so mildly rewatchable for you guys. Blaine hates this movie and will never watch it again. I, however, think it's a masterpiece, and I love it, and I hate you guys.
We said there was something to it.
No, I know. I also just, I, you know, a lot of these podcasts, we talk about dumb movies and kind of dunk on them, but this is one of my favorite movies, so I feel like I do need to talk about it seriously. And one thing we haven't mentioned is like the colors of this movie and like the way it's shot and the way it's the images are composed. I just think are so beautiful and so purposeful. And I just love the look of this film and the feel of this film and the intimacy of so many scenes, even in scenes that are being played very like off the wall and theatrical at times. But then I think they're almost more powerful because they can like change gears to like the most like raw, intimate moments you've seen captured in movies. I mean, some of these scenes, you know, Kubrick operated the camera and it was just like, you know, a crew of three or four people. Like it's a movie that's, I mean, it's cliche to say they don't make movies like this anymore, but I think it's a uniquely Kubrick movie. It's a unique, drama. You don't see this kind of movie aiming to explore adult themes in this way. Like it's just, I mean, even like the erotic thriller, like the 90s erotic thriller, which we kind of mentioned, is a genre that sadly is gone. Someone on a podcast was just talking about how, that there was like a theory that basically like the 90s erotic thriller was killed by like the internet and like the proliferation of internet porn.
That makes sense.
And I think there's something to that. And I think this movie is almost like the tail end of that, like almost like the big finale to that. Because, you know, it's funny to watch it now in 2020 because like a lot of what made it so taboo or so controversial is very tame now. Like the orgy scenes like that were so scandalous, they had to literally CG people in front of them. Like, those could be playing out in the background of a Game of Thrones scene 100%. While like a villain gives a monologue. But I mean, there's still something, that's why, you know, the craft of it is so important because it puts you into those places and into those moments and makes you feel the unease of them. I don't know. It's just a movie, you know, I put it on in the basement here. I've got a projector and a big screen and I was watching it late. I was going to just watch half of it down here and then watch the rest on like my iPad in bed, even though that seemed kind of sacrilegious for a Kubrick movie, but I still couldn't turn it off. I just like, I got hypnotized by it. I got locked into it and I was under the movie spell and I stayed up late and watched the whole thing, down in the basement. And yeah, I don't know. It's just a unique movie and I love it. And I know it has flaws. I'm not going to say it doesn't have flaws. One of the biggest flaws is like, I don't know why the secret orgy people don't just get a CD player.
Man. Like when Nick Nightingale is like, you know, scoring his friend's potential death, it's like gong, gong, boom, boom, boom.
No, I don't think he's there for that. I think he's already been discarded.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, like, I mean, just get those like weird synthesizer tones on like a MP3 player, yeah, or something.
Put on an Aphex Twin CD or whatever.
Well, somebody needed to have their eyes wide shut.
That's true. You know, that band Ghost?
Yeah.
They've become pretty big. My brother-in-law's band was opening for them once, so I went to their show, and their like intro music before they came out and took the stage was the Eyes Wide Shut Nick Nightingale music.
Wow.
Just like that, like, you know, that kind of thing. So
that's pretty metal.
I mean, yeah, this movie had a pretty, yeah. This movie had a huge pop cultural footprint, and I implore Blaine to return to it someday, maybe next Christmas. And, you know, put your phone away, you know, dim the lights, just try to...
get your cloak, get your mask. And,
yeah.
And get to the end of the rainbow.
Yeah.
Well, sometimes we don't get what we want at Christmas. I'm just saying. Nah, I'll probably try again.
Is it a whole movie about trying to recreate the feeling of that one shot from The Shining where like Rolf from the Muppets is giving a blowjob to that fog? And does it ever quite get there? No, but it's a valiant effort.
Yeah. Yeah.
There was one, you know, I don't know if I ever noticed this before, but like there's one shot where when Tom Cruise goes out and it cuts back, he's at work and it cuts back to Nicole Kidman and their daughter. and she's like smoking in the kitchen and they're watching Chuck Jones cartoon. They're watching The Grinch on the little TV. And it's literally like the same scene as The Shining. Like, it's crazy. Mm. Like, that must have been intentional.
Oh, yeah. She's like drinking milk and smoking cigarettes and eating like Drake's cakes.
Yes. Yes.
She's got to get a new job, you know? That character seems really depressed.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's our podcast for this week. Johnny, thank you so much for coming and suggesting this movie.
Thanks, man.
Always a pleasure.
You've saved Christmas.
For once.
Did you have anything you wanted to plug or promote? Just quarantining?
Oh, no, I might actually have a thing depending on when this drops.
Next Wednesday.
The 16th?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yes. Okay, then tomorrow night, by then, I'm going to be co-hosting a boylesque show called Stay Homo for the Holidays, : but actually, and I will be in character as Anne with a D, serving up a holiday special full of lighthearted mirth and a lot of butts. And
wow.
It's going to be happening over Zoom. You can find out about it if you look up BoylesqueTO on Instagram or Facebook.
Somebody should do a bit about Nicole, or tribute to Nicole Kidman's butt in Eyes Wide Shut in your show. That's what I would suggest that. I think, you know.
Eyes Wide, there could be some butt.
Yeah.
Oh, and that was another news story that came out recently, too, is someone asked Nicole Kidman about this movie, and she said that Kubrick gave her final cut over all of her nude scenes.
Yeah.
That's nice.
I mean, that's good. It's good that, like, because I know that Stanley Kubrick wasn't so good with Lady from The Shining, you know.
Yeah.
I wonder, it's good that he wasn't a total douchebag this time. This movie had the same thing. Likely not.
Well, the women that were in the orgy scene all said they felt really good about it too.
That's good. And
apparently, like, they rehearsed a lot, but that rehearsal just made everybody like super comfortable with the whole thing. I've read a lot about this movie, you guys. Keep going.
I guess if you're wearing a full mask, maybe it's a bit like, yeah, whatever.
That's true. Yeah, I'll do anything on film in a mask. And maybe that's a good point to mention our email, rewatchability@gmail.com. You could find us on Twitter, twitter.com/rewatchability. Or sorry, you can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/rewatchability, and on Twitter @rewatchability. And until then, what's the password, Rob?
Game Boy.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.